Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners will start dropping into our airwaves from China, the Pacific, and England. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media, companies that prefer people to profit, activists auditing our oceans, and mobile batteries that batter the environment. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and with Christmas just around the corner, today our mics are turning towards fair trade. In food, on electronics and clothing, as megastore and supermarket shelves become increasingly saturated with home brands, the information on the packaging gives us too little to confidently tell where a product was made, let alone what's actually in it. This makes it a hard ask to put our principles into practice with our purchases. By buying both brands that support more equitable trade with the developing world and goods made with properly paid labour. So today, we're taking a shopping trip in search of ethical products. But before we take out the trolley, let's first consider the potential that ethical shopping really has for building economic strength in the developing world. Jess Worth, also a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine, has been hunting around the stores. Here's what she thinks.
It's amazing the amount of ethical goods that you can buy on the high street has just snowballed over the last few years. More people than ever before are seeking out fair trade food and drink, organic vegetables, environmentally friendly sweatshops, free forest friendly, the list goes on. It's a huge boom, and you know, in many ways it's very exciting because it shows that people are really coming to recognise that so many of the products that we buy day to day are actually produced in very exploitative and environmentally destructive ways and are wanting to find alternatives that are much more, you know, environmentally and people friendly. But I think in terms of how much this is really helping the developing world, I think you need to take a step back and look at the big picture and look at what are the biggest problems facing the developing world today. And probably the biggest one is actually climate change, which itself is driven by overconsumption and people in rich countries just buying too much stuff, far too much stuff. And that's one problem that we're not going to be able to buy our way out of.
Indeed. I remember you saying when you researched ethical shopping that one of the most depressing things you were finding was that as soon as you scratch the surface, almost nothing is as ethical as it seems.
Yeah, I mean, you want it to be true, don't you? When you go into a shop and you see a picture of a happy, smiling farmer on the packaging and it says, you know, buy this and be part of saving the world. And yeah, you want to do that and you want that to be true. But unfortunately, the world is much more complicated than that, and the solutions aren't going to be found by consuming more stuff or consuming stuff differently. So organics is a really good example. I think you imagine when you buy organic food that you're buying into an alternative to the massive industrialized agricultural systems that are so damaging for the environment and also very exploitative for the people that actually work on these huge agri-farms. But actually what's happening is that organic is being taken over by the supermarkets and is essentially being put into those kinds of systems. So most small organic companies have now been bought up by multinationals, and a lot of the smaller, more sustainable farmers who have genuinely been trying to practice an alternative sustainable form of agriculture are being squeezed out of the market. And supermarkets, they're not doing it out of the good of their own hearts. You know, they've seen that there's a big market here. They can charge far more for organic goods than they charge for non-organic goods because people are willing to pay for it because they think they're buying into a more sustainable alternative, and they're actually exploiting the system and watering down standards. So it's really, really depressing, actually.
Yeah, I think you've gone to the heart of our debate today. We're just about to introduce two guests to actually widen out that whole picture, Jess. But before we go there, there are quite a few definitions of fair trade. What's yours?
fair trade can mean two different things. I think there's fair trade the philosophy and fair trade the brand. And fair trade the philosophy is all about a system where producers and consumers benefit equally, the environment is protected, and nobody at any point in that relationship is exploited, which is the complete opposite of the international trading system as it works at the moment. So for me, fair trade is all about a different system where the rules have changed to actually be fair to poor countries and fair to the people that don't have power within the global economy. Fair trade, the brand, is about giving farmers a fair price for the goods that they sell. And that's really, really important, but on its own, obviously, isn't going to transform the unjust global trading system.
So does that mean, if we see a sticker on a product marked fair trade, that it won't really deliver the ethical goods? We asked just this of two guests in January this year. Albert Tucker hails from Sierra Leone. He's a leading international fair trade consultant who was a director for 9 years with Twin Trading, a pioneering fair trade company. Barbara Crowther also joined us, championing the perspectives of Britain's Fair Trade Foundation. Barbara started the ball rolling.
We've had an announcement here in the UK from one big retailer, which is Marks & Spencer. Now, a few years ago, they weren't buying anything under fair trade standards. And over the last 2-3 years, they've gradually started switching the way in which they're managing their supply chains. And in fact, that has meant that they have been going out and directly meeting with producer groups. So very recently, they were out in Mali looking at what could they do, not just to buy cotton from the Mali cotton growers, but also to put in place additional programs and to try and seek additional funding to help those cotton farmers really look at how they can transform their communities, whether they could build up more sustainable businesses. Now, they claim that actually coming into fair trade has changed the way that they're thinking about the management of their supply chains. I think that's one way in which, you know, the fair trade label can help people move from a small step to a large step.
Because one of the examples you've just given, Marks & Spencer, some people in the UK would say that Marks & Spencer has been one of the prime companies that has just been using fair trade as a marketing tool.
If they were just simply wanting to do snappy marketing, I think there's probably cheaper ways of going about it. You know, what they've had to do, they worked for about 3 to 5 years looking at their tea and coffee supply chains and working with different suppliers, going out, meeting farmers, working very hard to help some farmers in Kenya actually come into the fair trade system for the first time. So it's very difficult just to slap a label on a product as a marketing tool. You have to go through a whole process of certification and supply chain checking. So I think they are moving in the right direction. I think what they are doing is worth something. It's certainly worth something to the farmers who are benefiting from it. Whether it's changing the world, whether it's changing the international trade structure, can it do that? I think it can send a signal out about the way in which we would like trade to be working.
Well, let's examine some of those signals. My favourite at the moment is the British arms manufacturer BAE Systems, who are selling ethical bullets. These are lead-free eco bullets because lead used in ammunition can harm the environment and pose a risk to people. Never mind about the injury or loss of life when the eco bullet gets fired from the gun. Isn't this an example of ethical trading being pushed by big companies just for the PR spin, Barbara?
I think there's two things. One is, could a bullet ever be ethical? And I think a lot of people, myself included, would argue that any bullet fired out of a gun could never be considered an ethical thing.
Absolutely.
Is it then right to try and reduce, given the fact that bullets are in existence, is it right to reduce the lead content of such things so that, you know, they're not then polluting the ground on which they fall? I would say yes, that's also better than whatever they were producing them, you know, than the lead they were using them before. So, you know, absolutely, rather not have bullets, if you're going to have bullets, rather not have polluting ones. I think it's a very difficult dilemma.
Albert?
Well, I'd like to take this issue a little bit, because the kind of language sometimes, what is being called ethical, this is one of my great reasons for supporting fair trade. Fair trade looks at a life system like trade. And I do want to change the world, by the way. That's why I went into fair trade. And people may think that's foolish.
Not at all.
Told me fair trade would never grow when I entered the business. So I do want to change the world and change the way trade is done. And I think the danger is sometimes we forget that that's why we did fair trade. So we start getting hung up on little ethical gains or small ethical gains. And that's not the important thing. Fair trade at least wants to use a live system to try and make change. That's what, how some of us see it. But I'd like to kind of move the discussion a little bit from the bullets and the genes and whatever else to why fair trade is important. It's not that some lone farmer on a hillside get a few pence more, but the PR round where people go and see farmers and talk to farmers. What farmers are worried about and what farmers tell me they're worried about by the introduction of multinationals and transnationals is that what fair trade started doing is giving them more say, more insight, more understanding and involvement in the market. So eventually they start really playing their own part in changing the system as well. When you have really powerful forces who control everything, simply going back to just buying off them, I think they have a problem with that. And you know, and this is important because in the world at the moment, say coffee, our most successful fair trade product as far as I know still, is only 0.5% of the global market. Right. So the bulk of that global market is still being traded unfairly in situations where farmers have no say, no control, no power. And that's why they thought fair trade could start the process of being involving them in that system to make change so that they can start building their own lives. It's not for us to develop their lives for them. So fair trade is important for that reason. And why some of us are frustrated with the way many multinationals come into the system is that they could do so much. You know, because of the power they have, if they let involve farmers and producers in developing countries more in that. And a final point I'd like to make is we talk about multinationals generically. So we've got retailers and we've got some of the coffee companies. Sometimes people get upset when one criticizes what's happening on the ground. There are also huge trading companies which buy from multinationals who behave terribly, not in the name of those multinationals. So there's different players along the chain who behave in very stages of exploitation along the chain. And farmers want all of that to be part of the system of change and trade change that happens. I was very involved in the last 8 to 9 years in the development of CAFE Direct and in TWIN, the organization I worked for. We were very focused on this issue of power and ownership of producers because really the future is not going to be what we in the North can do for people in the South. We have to create the terms and the environment where people can also do their own development. But also we saw farmers and worked very closely with farmers and we saw poor communities very much as people without opportunity, where opportunity is less or living in conditions of poverty, but really capable people. So ownership of the business became not our domain. You know, all the companies that Twin created were part owned by farmers, farmers involved in the strategies and same with CAFE Direct. Of course, even that, and I think it's a very good model we develop, even though as part of it I am biased. But I think that even that has faced challenges in a world where might seem to be right. So the biggest players will be looking to squeeze that model, the drive for bottom lines of profit alone, and not the environmental, not the social, not developing communities. It's making it challenging. But I think CAFE Direct's strength is that involvement of farmers. And for farmers, that approach to fair trade is a hell of a lot more interesting given the point I was making earlier about their ability to influence the market, and actually stronger because in a couple of years' time, they won't just be left in the lurch when a company loses interest because really fair trade is not central to its business. You know, imagine if the produce suppliers of Nestle or Cadbury's or any of the major commodities companies were the producers. Their policies would look very, very different.
Barbara, when the Fair Trade Foundation in Britain is making its assessment of who and who not to give ticks to, how far does it take consideration of the factors that Albert has just been talking about? Does your net cast?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're part of an international certification system, so no decision that the Fair Trade Foundation takes on these things is being taken entirely in isolation. If some certified producers want to sell their coffee on through a supply chain, how can we get the commitment of those companies to comply with the internationally agreed standards that we've laid out. Now, when those standards were set up, they were set up as a product certification system. So that means that it doesn't give an entire company endorsement. And the reason for that was that it was seen that, first of all, that product supply chains can be audited, and secondly, it allowed companies to engage with fair trade on an incremental basis rather than expecting them to change magically their entire way of working overnight.
Well, Nestle is a good recent example of whether you can give a tick to a fair trade product made by a company with arguable ethics.
I agree, I think that product has been certified is absolutely meeting the international standards. The company has worked very directly with the farmers involved. They've put a lot of additional support on the ground. They're working on diversification and alternative income generating programs. I think what they're not doing is they're not going as far as the models that Albert was advocating in terms of, you know, have those farmers got ownership of the profits of that brand, you know. So I think there's a lot more that they can do, but I do think it's a step in the right direction as opposed to a step in the wrong direction.
Yes, it might be a step in the right direction, but two decades ago, the magazine I work for, New Internationalist magazine, uncovered the scandal about how Nestle was pushing its product into Africa when it knew that poverty-stricken mothers were watering down Nestle baby milk so that it had little nutritional value.
And that's another issue.
Could I just finish the question? This is the nub of it. As I understand it, Nestle got the fair trade tick recently for its product, not its personality. And Barbara, I suppose my question is, how can you ignore a history of unfair trading when you're giving out the fair trade tick?
I think what we're trying to do is promote good practice. We're trying to get people to do the right thing. And if the product meets the standards, and it actually goes beyond the minimum international fair trade standards in terms of the engagement that they're involved in on that product. The product's name is Partners Blend.
It's a coffee.
And it comes from Ethiopia. It's a coffee, and it comes from Ethiopia and El Salvador. Now, I've met those farmers in El Salvador, and nobody was giving those farmers anything like a fair price. They told me times that they had sold their coffee for 4.5 US cents a pound. Because nobody was giving them a fair price. The question for me at that point was, if they have found somebody who's prepared to do that with them, who's prepared to pay them those prices, who's prepared to invest in additional program support on the ground, is it the job of the certification movement, which is what the fair trade label is it the job of the fair trade certification movement to help them achieve that, or should we stand in the way of those farmers achieving that? It's a difficult decision. It's by no means the only thing we should be doing with big multinationals like Nestle. There's a whole raft of other issues that need to be tackled. I don't think we can put the solutions to everything on fair trade. We've never said that fair trade is the only solution to the world's problems. But what we have said is it can help ordinary people to think about their values when they go shopping, to make responsible decisions as much as they can, and it can bring real benefits for the farmers involved. And hopefully then we can also send this wider signal out to the market that this is what people want to buy into. This is the model of trade, and we can use that to try and advocate for much greater reform, the kind that Jess was talking about. So I think that's why, you know, fair trade labelling, it's one tool, but it's not really, you know, it's not the end of the story. I think it's one part of it. So we certify products. We work as hard as we can then to push those companies down a line of thinking bigger about their supply chains, thinking bigger about what more they can do. Sometimes that's successful, sometimes it's less successful. But I agree with Albert, we need new models as well. You know, so Divine Chocolate here in the UK is another company that's part-owned by the farmers. So they have a say in its governance. We at the foundation, we've now opened our governance up. We were originally governed entirely by NGOs like Oxfam and Christian Aid. Now we've opened up our governance and we've got producer representation on our board, and we're increasingly trying to take, you know, the mood of those producer networks in looking at the big directions of fair trade in the UK. And I think all of these things are needed. You know, in order to try and really think through, you know, where can fair trade go next?
That was Barbara Crowther, putting the perspectives of Britain's Fair Trade Foundation. And before her, Albert Tucker, an international fair trade consultant working with producers in Latin America and Africa. Mm-hmm. listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And as the cash registers are ringing and the Christmas carolers are singing, today we're talking about ethical shopping. Now we're moving into some tasty morsels that might find their way onto your table this Christmas. Seafood. It's certainly a favourite in my country, Australia. In January this year, New Internationalist co-editor David Ransom talked with Greenpeace campaigner Sarah Holden, coordinator of a 15-month world voyage that was being undertaken by the Esperanza. At the time, the crew were looking for pirates responsible for fishing out 20% of the global catch, a $9 billion booty, and a major problem for us consumers, because how are we to know whether or not we're eating fish stolen from someone else's waters? David Ransom asked Sarah just who these pirates were.
Well, a lot of the ships come from countries like China, Taiwan, Korea, but a lot of them are also domestic vessels that simply are ignoring the rules and regulations. I was on the Esperanza earlier in her expedition in West Africa. Most of the vessels we came across there were Chinese and Korean. And essentially what they do is they move from ocean to ocean. And because the waters that they usually are in have been fished out, they're now moving to richer grounds. But the knock-on effects for those societies that are in the exclusive economic zone that the pirates are working in is that they are losing much-needed income and food. West Africa is the only region in the world where fish consumption is falling, and that's partly due to the number of pirates that are just taking far more than the local fishermen could ever dream of taking. And so not only is it stealing their food and their income, but it's also a completely unsustainable practice because there's no regulation. And as the oceans are a vast place, 70% of our planet, a lot of what goes on out there is completely invisible because there isn't any monitoring and there isn't any enforcement or observation on the high seas. And so it's quite hard to actually find these people whilst they're out at sea. We were the only vessel in this area, and so it becomes more and more difficult to do it at sea. But essentially, ocean protection begins on land anyway. They should never be allowed out there in the first place.
Do consumers have any idea at all whether the fish they were eating had been pirate-fished or not?
No, unfortunately not. But they can ask key questions of their suppliers. And this is one of the things that we're doing. We don't believe that it's for Greenpeace to prove that the fish is stolen. We believe it's for the suppliers and the retailers to prove that it isn't. And if they think that there's anything suspicious about where they're getting their fish from, then they should stop sourcing from those areas. In fact, very recently, we've had some of the Nordic retailers saying that they have made a commitment that they will no longer take cod from the Baltic because of the doubt over whether or not it's stolen, because at least a third of it is every year. And so what we're asking people to do, and retailers and supermarkets, is ask the questions, you know, what is what we call the chain of custody? Do you know where it was fished and who by? And how it was transferred back to land, and who was processing it. If you imagine it was cattle, then you can tell from all of the records where it was born, what farm it grew up on, what it was fed whilst it was alive, who killed it and who transported it, and what it ended up with before it was on your plate. And you can do that with cattle and with chickens and with all poultry. You can't do it with fish. And that's one thing that we need to make sure happens, is that people ask the questions and demand that their fish be caught in a way that isn't destroying the ocean.
I remember reading your blog on the Greenpeace website about what went on North West Africa, and you actually went up to some of these ships and demanded to know what they were doing.
We did, yes, because, as I say, we were the only people out there checking them out. An awful lot of the time, some of the conditions that we came across were truly horrific. If it happened on land, if it was a factory down the road from you, it would be shut down in 5 minutes because the conditions for the workers were appalling. The sanitary conditions that the fish were being kept in were equally shocking. And this is all stuff that's coming into Europe and possibly being eaten by the people who are listening to this program. And we were truly shocked by some of the things that we saw. We came across what we called the zombie graveyard.
The zombie graveyard.
Yeah, one of our crew is a science fiction nerd, and so he was saying this is like being with the undead, because they have been abandoned on ships 150 miles from shore, and every now and then, maybe once a month, a supply vessel would come by from the company that owned the ships and give them some supplies. All we ever saw them get was bags of cabbages. And they've just been left there, and they're not being paid, and they're not going out and fishing, and they have no hope of getting back to shore until the company decides that they're ready to bring them back. And they retain their passports in Las Palmas, thousands of miles away. And so it's like indentured slavery. And again, that's something that you would never tolerate on if you saw it on land. Some of the conditions that the fish were kept in were truly shocking. I mean, completely rusted refrigeration systems. It's only by showing exactly what's going on that we can hope to get change, because it's been going on for a very long time.
You came across pirate fishing in the Philippines and elsewhere as well, I think, didn't you?
Yes, we've come across it wherever we go.
Pretty much wherever there's fish, there's pirate fishing.
Yeah, basically every day in every ocean. Sort of, I think there's an assumption that poor nations have pirate fishing vessels in their waters and nobody else suffers. But we have evidence of pirate fishing in the North Sea and in the Baltic Sea, and it's not enforced. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the key to it is that the protecting the oceans has to start on land before the ships are even allowed out. And we want to see very much closer monitoring of vessels coming into port and what they're bringing in, where they've caught it, how they've caught it as well. And also questioning what we call flags of convenience, which are ships that can go to countries like Honduras or Panama and simply buy up a flag so that they become registered. But the country that has sold them the flag doesn't give any care about what they do once they're out on the water. So we want more responsibility by the states who register the vessels, and more responsibility taken by the states that accept their cargoes as well. And that way we'll start to see a change in attitude and stop pirate fishing.
I know that the Esperanza has been down in the Southern Ocean. And where is it now? It's in the Pacific by now, I guess.
Yeah. She's in the Pacific now, and it is a major problem in the Pacific. And what they tend to do there is, even if they do buy licenses, they buy them for a tiny fraction of the value of the fish that they're catching. And they mainly go for tuna. And we've seen already earlier in the expedition that tuna in the Mediterranean is in serious trouble. And tuna falls into the category of the big predatory fish. And in the last 50 years, 90% of all of those big predatory fish like tuna and swordfish and marlin have gone. And so it is a species that is in real trouble. 90%. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? As everywhere you go, there's a tuna sandwich. But without serious action to reduce the number that are being caught, there won't be for very much longer.
Indeed. That salutary warning was from Sarah Holden, sailing the seven seas on the Greenpeace vessel, the Esperanza. was Andy O from the CD Dig Dig, performed by Renee LaSalle and Bob Brosman. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking about ethical shopping. The next item on our shelf is electronic goods. Thinking of buying a better mobile for a loved one this Christmas? Or an upgraded computer for your kids? Before you buy, consider the waste. E-waste, that is. In May this year, the toxics campaigner for Greenpeace in China, Jamie Choi, outlined the problem.
You see, most of the electronic waste, as we call it, is produced in developed countries, but they are actually discarded in developing countries such as China. And the workers here have to bear the biggest health burden, and China has to bear the environmental burden associated with this. Actually, there's one town in southern China known as Guiyu that has been known to become the e-waste town. And you go to the street and all you see is just computers and mobile phones and electronic waste piled up in streets and people dismantling them. And there are lots of things associated with it. The reason why this is so important, this work is continuously increasing in China, is because there are lots of valuable scrap materials inside these electronic products, such as nickel or copper, and et cetera. And they want to take these things out. But while they're trying to take these valuable substances out, this creates an immense amount of pollution.
How is that pollution disposed of? Is it just discarded in piles, or is there some kind of formal mechanism to actually gather it up and use it in some way?
It's actually done in a very non-controlled environment, and you will see in streets of places like Guiyu where people will just be burning, for example, wires from computers, or burning the plastic, melting them to make some sort of other type of plastic. And this creates a huge amount of dioxins up to the air, which is very dangerous. Once you go into a town like Guiyu, you will just smell the electronic products being burned. And that's the kind of situation people have to live in.
I can imagine the health consequences for workers would be extreme. I mean, what you've just described would be extremely damaging for lungs. What other types of problems are people experiencing who are working on this disposal?
This is a very scary fact. Shantou University, which is a university around the Guiyu area, did a blood test for about 160 of the little children who live in the Guiyu area. They play with the electronic waste. They're always touching the electronic waste. And we found out that over 80% of the kids whose blood we tested had some sort of lead poisoning. Skin rashes is also something that you see a lot amongst the workers. The long-term effects, we really cannot tell, because this is not an industry that has been this active. This is a new type of waste that is being created. But we have a feeling that it's going to have long-lasting consequences in their lives, and we are yet to see the catastrophe that is caused behind this.
And we've been talking about workers, Jamie, but I can imagine for the environment too, we've got quite a substantial problem in terms of waste that is not disposable, is not actually going to break down.
You're definitely right. The problem with electronic waste is that they contain hazardous substances inside, and it is impossible to actually safely dismantle or recycle these electronic products. And this is where the environmental pollution will come out. For example, mobile phones have in themselves brominated flame retardants. They're used in circuit boards and plastic casings, and they do not break down easily and build up in the environment. Actually, scientists have found BFRs, or brominated flame retardants, in places as far as the North Pole and in polar bears. And this kind of shows how much environmental impact this has right now, and it will continue to have.
I'm wondering about other regions of China. We've been talking about one particular region of China. Are there other regions that are also being required to house the disposal of these computers and mobile phones?
Well, Chris, the one amazing fact about all this is that it is illegal. Actually, under the Basel Ban of 1994, it is illegal for developed countries to export toxic waste, including e-waste, into developing countries such as China. But this is still being done all the time. We have seen shipments coming out of Europe shipments are coming out of America, and they find a way to get into China. And this is a major problem, and it's definitely increasing. Guiyu, the town that I was describing you, is actually the main area of e-waste disposal, but we are definitely finding more and more small towns taking in this work because the extraction of valuable chemicals, valuable metals, is a very lucrative business for a lot of people.
And rural sectors are crying out for some kind of income at the moment too.
Definitely. So actually what you see is also a rising social problem. Most of the people who do the actual dismantling are people from rural areas in China, all throughout China, coming to these towns to do this work, and they get paid very little money, about $4 or $5 a day, to do this very, very dangerous work with very little protective gear.
Just a few figures, Jamie. Do you have a ballpark figure on how many mobile phones might have been imported from, say, for instance, the United States and Europe into China?
It's difficult to tell how much mobile phones there would be. I know that amongst electronic products, about 50 to 80% of electronic products end up in Asia to be discarded. And from that, about 90% ends up in China somehow. I also know that this is an increasing problem in China itself as the use of mobile phones and computers are increasing on a daily basis. According to the Ministry of Information Industry in China, they say about 459 million people use cell phones in China, which is about one-third of the entire Chinese population, and annually about 70 million cell phones get discarded.
Mm.
So only within China, this is the amount being created. You can add the amount coming in from the developed countries, and you can see how to figure that out.
Absolutely. So Greenpeace is encouraging electronics companies to dispose of their discarded products. How are you going about this?
Well, we are asking two things from companies. One is chemicals. We are asking computer companies and mobile phone companies to stop using hazardous substances in their entire range of products. That is our first demand. Our second demand is that mobile phone and computer phone companies start taking back their own products.
Haven't you still got a problem there? Like, they've still got to dispose of them, and where are they going to dispose of them?
Well, if it's computer companies or mobile phone companies taking the financial responsibility to take back these products, it will be done in a much safer manner. Although it is impossible to safely discard or recycle hazardous substances, they do have better technology. They are actually the people who made these products, so they have the best technology and know-how to dismantle it as well.
Yes.
Whereas if you go to a place like Guiyu in China, people are just doing it with their hands. They're acid bathing circuit boards. You see a lot of just really primitive ways of doing this.
And I can imagine, too, if there's a financial incentive there, you can bet your bottom dollar that there will be some research and development into how to actually dispose of these products efficiently and safely if they're handed back to
you're
the companies.
Right. You're right. I mean, if electronic companies started taking financial responsibility for the take-back of their products, this would actually encourage design because nobody wants to pay a lot of money for take-back, and they'll know that the products that they're making right now is very, very difficult to discard and dismantle.
So what's the reaction from the companies been like, Jamie? Are they going to do it?
There are lots of companies that have begun to take further steps on improving their environmental policies with regards to e-waste. Companies like Dell, Lenovo, Acer, and recently Apple just came to Greenpeace and the world saying that they will phase out their toxic substances. They've actually come up with a concrete timeline in which they will do this, which is really good news.
And Nokia, the largest mobile phone company in the world?
Nokia is actually one of the leaders of this matter. They do not have a comprehensive toxic phase-out timeline, which is what we require from companies, but they have been doing a lot better in take-back than most other companies. And they are having increasing amounts of products that are free of hazardous substances. So that is always very good news.
That was Toxics Campaigner for Greenpeace in China, Jamie Choi. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, produced by that progressive publication New Internationalist Magazine, which for the last 30 years has been presenting the ideas and the action in the fight for global justice. Each month, New Internationalist Magazine introduces you to ideas and people not often found in mainstream media. go to www.newint.org and sign up now for your free trial subscription. Listening to our previous guest, Jamie Choi, talk about e-waste, you can't help thinking that one of the most ethical of all shopping tips is to think twice before buying replacement products, electrical or otherwise. New Internationalist co-editor Jess Worth outlines a number of others.
Well, I think one of the first things to say is that while it's important to shop as ethically as you can, it's not going to sort out all of the problems of the world, and we need to recognise that from the start. It's difficult to be an ethical consumer in a fundamentally unethical world, and it's more important yes. to take political action. Having said that, I think there's a series of questions you can ask yourself that are really, really useful to minimise the impact that your shopping habits have on the rest of the world. The first one is, do I really need to buy this? Do I actually need this product because energy and resources have gone into it and maybe people have been exploited while it was being made and we all need to consume less? So that's the first question that's important to ask yourself. If you still need it, can you get it without actually buying a new one? Can you get it second hand? If it's food, can you grow it? There are all kinds of ways of not bringing new stuff into the world, basically, that it's really important that we all start adapting to. Then if you do need to buy a new thing, you need to balance out the importance of minimising environmental impact by buying locally, as much locally produced and sourced food as you can. That also, in turn, will support local farmers and support the local economy. Obviously, you can't get all your food locally, and I think that's where fair trade comes in, tea, coffee, sugar, and so on. But I think you want to be making sure that you're not buying food that's actually been flown around the world, because that's the most environmentally damaging thing that you can do, really, with food. Mm. If it's been flown around the world, it's probably also been refrigerated and packaged and so on.
One of the interesting debates, I think, that as an organisation, we're a workers' cooperative, New Internationalist, one of the debates we had surrounding practicalities, for instance, supermarkets, inherently unethical on all kinds of levels, in terms of transportation of goods in terms of the squeeze down effect on producers, but all of us shop in supermarkets. So can you develop that a little bit more for us?
Yeah, it's difficult because supermarkets have so successfully taken over the food chain, certainly in the rich world, and are expanding extremely rapidly in the majority world as well. It does seem like for a lot of people, they don't have any option other than to shop at supermarkets. I don't think that's always true. I think what my advice would be is to just see if there are ways of cutting down on the amount of goods that you do need to buy at supermarkets. Probably won't be possible to not buy anything at a supermarket, but look at other ways of getting food, like through mail order from Whole Foods companies. You know, every country has got lots of companies that you can find online or through the phone book who you can buy much more ethically sourced goods from as an alternative to supermarkets. You can get together with your friends and form a buyer's co-op and buy in bulk, and then it's a lot cheaper.
Yes.
I think we need to start finding more community-based solutions to the problems that are facing the world. And while we shouldn't be beating ourselves up about the situation that we find ourselves in, the dominance of supermarkets, we need to recognise that it's an enormous problem and that it's something that we do need to start challenging.
Indeed. I mean, one of the interesting parts about shopping organically in my country, Australia, is that it costs much more. It can often cost almost double the price of a supermarket. And so you have people, some students, for instance, on fixed incomes, some people generally on fixed incomes, who say, isn't this classist? Isn't this angst class-based? It's really nice when you've got money, but we haven't got any money.
Yeah, it is. And like I said, you know, ethical consumerism is for people who have the money to consume and to make these choices. It's a luxury. It's a very rich Western middle class thing. And that's why it's not the solution. Students who care about these issues and want to do something about it should not beat themselves up because they can't afford to buy fair trade coffee from a supermarket. They should be using the time and the knowledge they have and the fact that they're part of a community of other people who they can organise with to actually start challenging politically the cause of climate change, of underdevelopment, of global injustice. That's a far more useful way of spending your time than, you know, scouring the streets trying to find a packet of fair trade coffee that you can afford.
Absolutely. That was New Internationalist co-editor Jess Wirth. And if you're interested in finding out more about ethical shopping, check out the New Internationalist magazine archive at www.newint.org, which is where you'll find a comprehensive magazine right on target.
Ella dijo adiós. Y me acuerdo de la lluvia que te mojaba tu cuerpo. Y en el manto de la noche te la secaba yo a besos. Ay, amor de medianoche, ay, amor de media pasión. Te fuiste de madrugada, no me diste ni adiós. Y amigo, que el más amigo la pega. Solamente hay un amigo, dinero en la fardiguera. Carambola del camino, carambola del amor. Sabe cómo llega el alba. Yo le di adiós, ella dio adiós.
Was Carambola, sung by Spanish vocalist Benjamin Escorita. More about how to locate this CD later in the program, because you might want to buy it. To conclude our dream for a fair trade Christmas, Australian author and academic Sharon Bader puts shopaholism in context.
Do you feel overly preoccupied with shopping and spending? Do you feel that your shopping behaviour is excessive, inappropriate, or uncontrolled? Have your shopping desires, urges, fantasies, or behaviours ever been overly time-consuming, caused you to feel guilty or upset, or led to serious problems in your life, such as financial or legal problems or the loss of a relationship? These are questions that Professor Donald Black suggests in a recent paper in World Psychiatry that psychiatrists ask people whom they suspect of having CBD, compulsive shopping disorder. If you answered yes to these questions, you may have CBD and be in need of treatment. This is a disease that tends to strike people in their late teens or early 20s, about when they get their first credit card. Of course, if you are preoccupied with shopping and spending and regularly let yourself go and shop excessively, buying inappropriate items, but you're wealthy, then you won't feel so guilty about it and you won't land in debt or get in trouble with your significant other. CBD is a supposed medical disorder that discriminates. It only strikes at those who can't afford to spend freely. When Elton John spends £40 million in 2 years, he's not diagnosed as having CBD. Reading of the latest proposed sale of government assets, I realised that our politicians are perhaps afflicted with a complementary disorder, compulsive selling disorder. Here are some questions you might want to put to your local member. Do you feel overly anxious to sell off state assets? Do voters feel that your selling behaviour is excessive, inappropriate, or unwise? Have your privatisation behaviours or goals ever been overly optimistic or led to serious problems such as rising or wildly fluctuating utility prices, unreliable public services, or the loss of environmental amenity? The difference between CBD or compulsory buying disorder and CSD or compulsory selling disorder, of course, is that the individual and their family suffer the consequences of CBD buying whilst the wider community suffers the consequences of CSD selling. And whereas CBD is said to affect less than 6% of the population, many of them women, particularly around Christmas time, CSD affects the majority of elected politicians, their economic advisers, and senior bureaucrats. Like CBD, CSD can negatively affect relationships, particularly the relationship between elected politicians and the people they represent. CSD-affected politicians are likely to ignore public opinion and even go ahead with sales that will lose them elections and lose government's money. The CSD impulse is so strong that politicians are often unable to delay their urge long enough for the appropriate research into possible consequences to be undertaken. They also tend to be in denial about the past experiences of other states or nations that have sold off similar assets before them. Treatment for CBD ranges from the use of antidepressants to cognitive behavioural therapy, but there is little evidence that current treatments are effective. To date, the only treatment available for CSD is shock therapy at election time. But we really should come up with something better because this is often too late and the damage has already been done. There are currently self-help books available for CBD, and if some bright spark, a recovered former politician perhaps, could just come up with a definitive self-help book for CSD-afflicted politicians, we'd all be much better off.
They were the thoughts of Sharon Bader about compulsive market disorders. Sharon's the author of Free Market Missionaries and Suiting Themselves, both published by Earthscan last year. And Rachel Marr was the reader. The music that we've been playing in today's program comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. We've been listening to two CDs. Elebanta, which is the first solo album from Benjamin Escoitha, and Dig Dig, performed by René LaSalle and Bob Brosman, which is also the CD on which you'll find the theme song coming up now. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Which is also where you'll find a copy of this program, just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Marr. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.